Today is October 28th, 2012, and this is our sixth class in the fall series on the Sutra on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. So who would like to read exercise 20? Somebody have a book? Nancy, you want to? Oh, Carolyn?
Sowing seeds of peace. When the factor of awakening, joy, ease, letting go is present in him, he is aware. Joy is present in me. When joy is not present in him, he is aware. Joy is not present in me. He is aware when not yet born joy is being born, and when already born joy is perfectly developed.
Thank you. So this is one of the seven factors of awakening, the factor of joy. And today we're going to investigate all the seven factors so that by the end of it we'll be fully awake. So the sutra goes on to say, in the same way, he is aware of the factors of mindfulness, investigation, diligence, ease, concentration, and equanimity. So those are the seven factors. So why is this important to study these? Well, the Buddha said that the seven factors of awakening lead to the complete destruction of suffering. Nothing is as efficient as these, he said. So if you're still attached to your suffering, you might want to think twice about doing this practice. But if you're ready to let go, then this is the express route. The Buddha also said, whoever practices the four immeasurable minds, if you remember those in our previous class, the four immeasurable minds of love, together with the seven factors of awakening, the four noble truths and the noble eightfold path, will arrive deeply at enlightenment. So it's all this package that we're studying. And then the Buddha also said that the way to realize the seven factors is the practice of the four foundations of mindfulness, what we've been doing. So we know that this isn't really a linear path. And at the same time, each of these builds on the next one. So we can kind of look at them in a linear way, knowing that, you know, we're really, there's cycles and cycles and depths and layers. But the first one is mindfulness, and each factor does build on the next. And so mindfulness is the basis of all of the factors of awakening. It kind of primes the pump for all of the other factors to begin to emerge and manifest in our lives. You know, they're already there, these wholesome energies, they're already within us. We're not adding anything. But to wake them up, you know, we need first mindfulness as the basis. So this is how we practice, the Buddha tells us. First, we train ourselves to notice when one of these factors is arising, or it has arisen, or is being maintained and dissolves. So that's been one of our practices. We notice our breath coming, sustaining and going. We notice a feeling come up, arise. Like Janine said, her strong feeling in her body came up, stayed for a while, and dissolved. We notice our thoughts, the same pattern. We're noticing, that's the refuge of impermanence, the truth of impermanence that we take to this. And so that's our first practice that we do. And then we also train ourselves to attend to a factor that hasn't arisen in us. And we train ourselves to cultivate that. That's like cultivating the good seeds. So we're aware when something arises, because all of these factors are wholesome. So it's not that, you know, we want them all. So we train ourselves when something has arisen, we pay attention to it. And when it hasn't yet arisen, we're aware that this factor, so it's good to look at them all and say, well, you know, I'm pretty good at mindfulness, not so good at concentration, equanimity, I don't even know what that is. So, you know, this is our way that we investigate and start to cultivate these factors in ourselves. So for each of the seven factors, we're going to look at them. I'm going to kind of present them. And for each factor, I'll offer its characteristic, its function, and how it manifests. So if this is helpful information to you, then that's great. You know, if you like this kind of structure, if it's not really helpful to you, it's not like something you have to memorize or something you have to know, or, you know, if the Buddha came in and we start quizzing you on what's the characteristic of the third factor, you know. So just take the information in your heart and your mind and use it as it helps you to be clear, and as it helps you to cultivate these factors and to recognize them in yourselves. Because as we talk about them, of course, you're going to want to recognize, where is this factor already arisen in me? I am a joyful person, or I know how to concentrate, or, you know, whatever. Because that's a very vital part of the practice. So mindfulness is the first one. And one of the aspects of mindfulness is that it captures our experience and it remembers it later. And this is kind of interesting to me in my sort of neuroscience interest, because there's a study that shows, and when you think about it, memories create our sense of self. If we didn't have any memories, we wouldn't have a sense of our own self. So that's one of the functions of remembering. You know, mindfulness is actually literally translated as remembering. So the characteristic of mindfulness is not wavering and going deep. And this translates into mindfulness brings us into the present, so we don't miss our appointment with life. So it's a steady awareness, which brings a momentum to your waking up. And then its function is to remember. So there's a few kinds of remembering. First, it helps you remember where you are. You know, it's like that on a map and it says you are here, you know. So you remember where you are in the scheme of things, in your time and place of your life and of the world and of the other beings around you, where you are. And it's also about remembering to ground in this moment. And another way to say that is to sort of to take your stand. The people who were in the spring class might remember about when we practiced mindfulness of the body, a standing meditation. And it's like taking your place in the world, you know, standing, being present, stability, you know. Planting the flag of stability and anchoring and groundedness. In the indigenous cultures, you know, almost all indigenous cultures have some sort of a stance that's like, I am here, I am present, you know. So it has that kind of energy to it, which is a very wonderful, you know, if you don't have that, how can you really show up, you know? And it manifests, mindfulness manifests as guarding, as protecting. And this is a true protection. There's really no better protection than mindfulness. Because you can see that when you're present, when you're aware, you're much more sensitive to what's going on within you and also in your environment. So you're able to respond much more subtly to the elements that are coming in. You know, when you practice mindfulness meditation regularly, your intuition develops. You know, well, your intuition may be just that you're more aware of what's really happening, and so you're responding to more subtle clues of what's happening in your own self and in your environment. It also gives us that opportunity to pause before we react or respond to something. And so that's a huge protection. We don't get caught in a reactive cycle when we're mindful. We can stop and ask ourselves, is this useful? Is this helpful? Who's speaking? Who's responding? You know? And so it's a great, that's why we call it the path of non-harming. You know? It keeps us from causing harm and generating harm and adding to harm to some painful scenario in life. And it helps us not to harm others. And there's also another aspect of this protection of mindfulness being a guardian for us, and it's the aspect that we talk about in a practice sometimes with, we call beginning anew, and it's the practice called beneficial regret. Now, I don't know if you looked at that sheet of paper I passed out several weeks ago on the 51 forms of mental formations, and one of them in the beneficial category is shame. And when I first got that, I thought, oh, I don't see anything beneficial about shame, you know. But it's referring to this beneficial regret. It's referring to, it's what keeps you from being a sociopath. It's your conscience. It's your remorse. It's your regret. And it's such a wonderful guardian for you. You know, it's so helpful. Imagine if we didn't have that. So it really helps us to practice non-harming. I don't know who said this, but I have a quote here. No deed is good that one regrets having done. So, you know, it's all about really not just what is it a good thing or not, but is it appropriate? Was it the right time? You know. So mindfulness protects us. So the next factor of awakening that naturally arises out of mindfulness, you know, you can imagine you kind of wake up and you're looking at the world with fresh eyes and you're fully present. What do you want to do next? You want to look more carefully and closely. You know, remember that curiosity that we've been developing. So that's what it naturally leads you into this world where you want to look more. So this it's called investigation of phenomena. You know, so we want to investigate what is, okay, so we're now we're awake, we're alert, we're curious, we're open. What's here? So we begin our investigation. And this is a factor of wisdom, the wisdom factor in our path, the insight. In the Eightfold Path, it's called right view. So its characteristic is penetrating things according to their individual essence. So you see, like, you have to use your mindfulness, and then you use your factor of investigating to really see something for what it is. You know, it's using your clarity. And its function is to illuminate the objective field like a lamp. So it's like shining the light on something, bringing clarity to whatever it is you're investigating by just being that beam of light. And it manifests as clarity, or as they like to say it, non-bewilderment. Remember how they use the negative, the not this, you know, because we're just uncovering. You know, when we're not bewildered. So wisdom is what brings us to awakening. It's what cuts through our limited view and our wrong perceptions. So we have on the Bodhisattva path, You know, we have these bodhisattvas, these beings who are archetypes for these factors and for these qualities that we want to cultivate. And so the quality of wisdom, the wisdom factor, which is this investigation of phenomena, is represented by a bodhisattva called Manjushri. And Manjushri has this big sword, you know. So what is the sword for? Cut through the illusion, you know. And sometimes you really need to do that. Sometimes you really need that sword to really cut through, you know. We need the other factors to unsheath the sword, but it's really the sword that cuts through our confusion. It's a sword of clarity, of insight, of wisdom. The Dalai Lama says, the process of overcoming our defilements goes in conjunction with gaining higher levels of realization. In fact, when we speak of gaining higher levels of realization in Buddhism, we are speaking primarily of the processes through which our wisdom and insight deepen. It is actually the wisdom aspect that enables the practitioner to move from one level to the next on the path. So this is really essential, because if we're not clear, you know, we can have all the energy in the world, but it's not going to be helpful or useful if we're not clear. This is what Thay is referring to, and I've heard Thay say on a number of occasions, practice with intelligence, you know, which I also think is like the subtext of that is use your common sense, you know. It's like, don't get all theoretical. Practice with your intelligence. Use your clarity, you know, to know what's right and appropriate for you at the time. So the light that shines, you know, like the sun or like a lamp on everything, allows us to look and inspect carefully and investigate. So what is it we're investigating? We're investigating our false views of ourselves and of the world, where we haven't really seen clearly. Our belief in permanence, our belief in separation, those are kind of the key ones that we're going back to over and over and questioning. Our belief that the satisfying of our grasping or our aversion will make us happy and fulfilled. We need to keep questioning that. The light shines on our motivations, our agendas that are created by our ego needs, that come from our unhealed wounds and our wrong understanding. So it can be a messy process. but it's like the sun that shines on everything equally and has a great healing power. You know, if you've ever had a wound and you open it to the sun, you know, you want the light to get to it, the light and the air to heal it. So that's what we're doing. It's the process of having the courage to open our wounds to the light so that healing can happen. You know, we don't have to figure out how to heal it, but we need to have the courage to open. So this is how the light of understanding helps us to reveal those hallucinations of perception that we talked about last time, especially our belief that we're separate and that we need to sort of continually shore up this sense of identity, you know, this sense of I-ness, which just leads us to inevitable continued suffering. So it's a big challenge. You know, and there's two kinds of suffering. There's one kind of suffering that just leads to more suffering. And then there's another kind of suffering that leads us out of suffering. And it's all in our ability, our courage, and our determination to wake up, you know, and to transform. So first of all, of course, we need to be comfortable enough when our suffering arises to be able to stay with it. And like Janine's example, to be able to have the presence. That's why we practice mindfulness in the good times, so that when something comes up, that's our default. We go, oh, what is this? This feels really uncomfortable, you know, and yet we can stay with it. We don't get sucked completely into it. We're able to stay with it and to actually have the joy, like she said, of watching it transform. You know, that's really quite amazing. It says, with the light of investigation, of insight, we see that what we take as self is just momentary paired progressions of knowing an object. So again, we go back to the sense organs and the sense bases and the objects and the consciousnesses, and this is what we are, you know, this six-piece chamber orchestra. That's what we are, you know. It's like color and form are distinguishable but inseparable, you know. Like Lilibet has a brown jacket on. I see that it's brown and I see that it's a jacket. So they're two different descriptions, but I can't take the brown out of her jacket because it's a brown jacket. So it's able, you know, we become more able to see distinctions, that things just aren't, they're just qualities of our sense impressions. And then, arising from that careful investigation comes the third factor of enlightenment, which is called virya, or energy. So it's you've wakened with mindfulness, and then you begin to walk into this. I'm just seeing this like, sort of like the forest in Avatar or something, with all the plants and birds and creatures and stuff, and like this new world. And so I've awakened to this world, and then I'm investigating it, looking carefully and closely. And then what comes is this is energy. I mean, I'm fascinated with this world. And Thay likes to use the word diligence. It's really the capacity for action. I think of it as my chi or my life force. And the Tibetans call it joyful effort, which I like very much. And also enthusiasm. You know? It's that I think of it in the time when I've been ill or had the flu or something like that. There was a time actually when I came back from Vietnam and I didn't know what had happened, but it turned out that I had gotten parasites. And there was a year and a half of misdiagnosis and mistreatment, and my energy just was lower and lower and lower and lower. And I remember the moment when I got to this low point. It was like gotten up at 10 o'clock in the morning. It was like all I could do was like go sit on the couch. I was just exhausted, and I thought, I just can't keep living like this. I don't know what's going on. If you get the flu or a cold or something, you know, and your life force is just not there, you know, you can barely kind of crawl out of bed. And I hope nobody gets sick this winter. But if you do, it's a great opportunity to practice with virya and to notice when it's not present, you know. Because, you know, when you come out of all of a sudden you're feeling better after being sick, you know, you feel so good. It's like, oh, I feel like doing that, and I'm going to go water the garden or do, you know. And at first, you know, it's the most wonderful aspect of your life that you actually have some energy, you actually feeling okay, you know. And then, of course, we begin taking it for granted and, you know, whatever. That's kind of the nature of things. But everything that happens to us is an opportunity to notice that. So notice that life force, that energy in you, and the waxing and the waning of it. You know? So the characteristic of virya, energy, is driving towards something. And I think this is a really interesting practice, how to do this without striving, without pushing, without grasping, without turning it into a project. And we're using our mindfulness for one thing, and our investigation capacity. And so then it's got this joyful aspect to it. So it's like moving towards something, but knowing that there's no need to go anywhere. You know, cultivating that kind of process in you. The function of virya is to harness the capacity to cultivate, develop, and respond to our wholesome desire to contribute to life, to be happy. So, you know, we all beings want to contribute to life. Sometimes that gets very distorted from suffering. All beings want to contribute. So this is what this is. It comes from that deep desire to contribute to life, to be part of life. And it manifests as strength and courage. So courage is so interesting, you know. Courage is quite a word. It powerfully engages our heart. You know, the word cor is heart, C-O-U-R, is heart. It comes from the word heart. I love that, you know, that character Braveheart. You know, that's really the definition of courage, you know, Braveheart. And it includes the ability to rise to the occasion, you know, the ability to respond in times of, if you need to stand up, you can. It's okay. It's all right. To respond, you know, to something that might be challenging, you know, and to not get discouraged, you know, to lose heart, perhaps about the enormity of the task or the amount of suffering that seems to be involved. And it's the ability to extend our limits. You know? And we've probably all been in this situation where a little more is asked of us than we really are ready to give. But we step up because that seems to be what's needed. And we find that place in our hearts. We find the strength in us, in ourselves, to offer a bit more. So that's the strength and the power of this energy. It's also interesting to know and be reminded that effort creates energy. You know, we always think, well, I'd like to go exercise, but I'm too tired. You know, and actually, if you get out and you start walking, you feel that that's when you get the energy, is from actually moving. You know, and there's a chef named Maddalena who used to have a show on JPR. I think she had a restaurant in Dunsmuir, and still does maybe. And the motto for her radio show was "Eating awakens the appetite." And I always liked that. It was first I'd go, huh, you know. But it's that same thing. It's like you start and the energy comes, you know. Inspiration comes. So some of us just naturally have more energy, more stamina, you know, than others. It's just kind of what we were given in terms of our nature, you know. And so there's ways to develop this energy. If you'd like to have more of this life force energy, the Buddha suggests a number of ways to develop it. So first of all, you contemplate just how precious this life is and how rare the circumstances are. And I've heard this so many times, I kind of go, oh yeah, life is precious. <You know? laughs> So I kind of was thinking, how do I translate that into my life? And how that translates into my life is really the closeness of death. And I couldn't relate to that either for many years of my life, but now I'm at a point where I can relate to that. I can relate that death is close, you know. And that I've had some wake-up calls. And probably most of us in this room have had some form of wake-up call that is basically telling us life is not unlimited. You know, don't squander it. You want this energy, you want to cultivate it, and you want to use it in the way that will give you the most bang for your buck, you know, that will make you the happiest and the most fulfilled. So that's, if you're feeling a low, you know, level of energy, to just be aware of that, and then to realize there are things that you can do to help cultivate this energy. We have a patriarch. He's our sixth patriarch in our lineage, back to the Buddha in Vietnam. And he was a real amazing guy. And he said, practice like your hair is on fire. So he really had this one down. I don't know what bald people do, but but he said, practice like your hair is on fire. And that's a really good image. When we practice, wisdom naturally grows. And when we don't practice, it wanes. So then what arises from the practice of wise energy, we'll do one more and then we'll have everybody break, is the fourth factor, which is called pitti. And pitti is what the seeds, the 20th exercise is on, joy, happiness, delight, rapt attention. It's called rapture. I think that can be misleading. Zest, you know. So it's a real delight. It's a real, to me, it has a real flavor of innocence to it. Its characteristic is it makes life sweeter. It's got that freshness and that openness. Its function is that it refreshes the body and mind. And it manifests as elation, lightness, playfulness, and joy.
What was the word again?
Pitti, P-I-T-T-I.
Thank you.
So the energy, you know, that you've carried into this new wonderful world that you've awakened to and you're investigating, the energy turns into delight, you know, of course, you know, at all these wonderful new things that you're experiencing. And when this is present, when this pitti, this joyfulness is present, there's no room for ill will. There's really no room for it. Those people with tendencies toward aversion, it would be good, really good to cultivate this aspect of the awakening process. The turning away, the people who say, you know, there's people who say, I want this, I want that, I like this, I want that, you know. And then there's people who their initial response is, I don't like that, I don't like that, I don't want that, I don't want that. And so those don't want people, this is a really wonderful practice to cultivate, you know, finding delight in our world. I think that it just means that finding that essence of it in you that's already there. I mean, we were all toddlers, you know. And when we were toddlers, we were full of this, you know, completely full of this energy of just rapt attention and delight in this world, you know. So it's going back and finding that energy in us and allowing that to be present in us. The danger that can be a danger in this factor being too much in us, and that is that there could be several dangers, but one is that we can identify with it too much. You know, we get here and it's a great place to be. Anybody want to go on to any more factors? No, let's just stay there with playfulness and delight. Why not? You know, so that's, you know, in our meditation, we can get to a place, oh, this is really pleasant, you know. And so it's wonderful. It's wonderful to be there. It's wonderful to accept it. And it's wonderful to not cling to it. Because, you know, in itself, it's not the answer. You know, it's just one of our aspects to cultivate and be aware of and to let go of. like everything else.